Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today J. Frederick Arment. He's just published The Elements of Peace, How Nonviolence Works. He joins us in studio here in Yellow Springs. Is it okay if I call you Fred?
That's fine. Nice to be here, Vic. Thank you.
Fred, is this your first work in nonfiction?
It is, actually. I've done a little bit of fiction work, but this one has been in process for about 10 years and finally came to fruition. It's being published actually this month by McFarland.
And I get the sense from reading the book that it's actually been in process for about 40 years.
Yes.
Tell us what was the impetus for this.
Well, as many of the people in the audience, as we moved through the decades, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, there was a point in our lives where we made a decision on what we were going to do in life and how we were going to approach life. And it came to me in the early 20s when I was in college and taking political science, and the 60s had just ended and the 70s had begun. And we were trying to figure out where we were as a generation, and were we going to follow the route into politics in the era of Watergate, et cetera, or were we going to take a more aggressive stance, become a part of the Weather Underground or one of the other groups? And so a lot of us who took things a little bit seriously at that point decided that we were going to take an approach of nonviolence. So nonviolence has been in my history for quite some time.
In that same period, some people were going to the war in Vietnam.
That's right, yes.
And eager to do so.
Right.
So we have a wide range of views here. Obviously, peace is important to all of us. We all want peace, but...
Yes, absolutely. Matter of fact, a couple of days ago, I had something that happened to me personally that I didn't realize before this interview I was going to have come into my life, but it was a letter from my father that was written in 1945 in the Philippines, and I just saw this letter for the first time on Sunday. And my father was a medal winner, Bronze Star, in the infantry, in the army, in World War II. He was in the front lines in the Philippines. So my brother found this letter from my father that was written right after one of the big battles. And he had left, he was drafted and went into the war, and he became an infantryman and went into a pretty intense area right before the war ended. And he wrote this five-page amazing letter about what his thoughts were while he was in the war zone. And he had been with a unit that went in to take a Japanese town. I'm going into this, I guess, because there's a point to it about the decisions we make. And this is repetitive, comes up war after war, person after person. And my father dug a foxhole, and he had a radio. He was a radioman, so they had the wires and a tent over his head. And five Japanese tanks came out of this town that they were trying to take. And so they saw this tent. So the tanks were firing on this tent. So his tent was full of holes, and the dust was flying, and dirt was in his eyes. He was writing this in the letter, and he survived. And eventually what he called the Doughboys actually won that battle and took that town. And he wasn't... a peace advocate or a peace person, as we call them. So, but there was a point in the letter that he said, "I've seen all I want of this war," and it was separated from the rest of the paragraphs. And I saw that moment when he was writing that letter and when he was in that foxhole as a decision point in his life. And he was a very honest man. That's one thing that I got from him. People have certain virtues, and honesty was a big one with my father. And he actually, at that point, I could tell from the letter, had an epiphany, and it was based on his honesty and his courage that he saw the war as the enemy and not the Japanese. And even though the letter had a lot of nomenclature about the Japs and, you know, going in and taking them out and things like that. There was that point where I believe his decision, and he saw the world honestly at that point, and the war was actually the enemy and not the Japanese.
With that being said, my father also served in the Pacific in World War II, and Studs Terkel wrote a book of oral history where he interviewed a lot of World War II veterans, and he called it the Good War. If they hadn't fought that war, obviously war is a horrible thing, but was there an alternative?
Yes. Yes, and that's what came to me over the years. What is the alternative to war? What is the alternative to violence? So as we contemplate that, what I began to realize from some of the experiences I've had over the last decade or so is that everyone has a decision to make, whether they're going to be a bully, whether they're going to work for peace, whether they're going to work for a better world. And there's so many different ways to do that. I happen to be one of the founders of Dayton International Peace Museum, and what we found was that there were no exhibits about peace. There were a lot of exhibits about war. So the only thing we had to go by was the Nobel Peace Prize winners. That was one of the only things. And we were able to create an exhibit for that, but there was no exhibit for how people work for peace. And what I found from being director is that everyone who walked in that door, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, had a different way of working for peace. They were nurses. They were teachers. They were policemen. There was all these different avenues for people to work for a better world, and that's what was the impetus for this book.
My guest is J. Frederick Arment. His book is The Elements of Peace, How Nonviolence Works. Tell our listeners how you structured the book and how you came up with this particular format.
Well, the idea was that we need to teach children that there are many ways to work for peace, and whatever your personality is, there is a way to work for a better world. So I structured it by coming up with first a few. I talked to Irwin Abrams, who you knew. He was an expert on Nobel Peace Prize winners. He was a friend of many of us. And he had a way of talking about peace in a positive way instead of a negative way. And so we need to be positive about peace, and we need to tell kids that whatever their personality, whatever their traits are, that they can find a way. So we came up with 16 different ways: diplomacy, statecraft, mediation, arbitration, the ones you can think of pretty quickly. And so I started investigating that and started creating an exhibit for the Peace Museum. And then we came up with 18 different ways. And people would come in and say, oh, you know, you ought to add this, you know, you ought to have art and things like that. So all of a sudden it began to accumulate. And pretty soon we had 25 different ways of working for peace. And when the book was pretty well going, actually came up with 30 different ways to peace, ranging from very personal ways, artistic expression, personal transformation, and then ways that, you know, we've created businesses with arbitration and mediation and things like that.
When you got up to number 29, were you going,
oh, I need one more? And there were a lot of suggestions, but I said, nope, that fits in the other one.
So,
yeah.
The book is The Elements of Peace. You just mentioned the late Irwin Abrams, emeritus professor at Antioch College. He was on this program a number of times, on WYSO a number of times. In fact, back in the day, every time they announced the Nobel Peace Prize, Irwin would be asked to come in, and he would talk to former station manager Brian Gibbons about the prize, and Irwin really knew everything about it. But he even got to nominate people, and for years he nominated Jimmy Carter until finally Jimmy won, and
yes,
there was Irwin in Oslo with Jimmy Carter. I've
right.
seen the photograph. He was an amazing man, an amazing authority on peace and the Nobel Peace Prize.
World renowned, no question about it. His mind was just more than razor sharp all the way up until the late 90s. It was very pleasing to get to know him at the end of the days.
Dayton, Ohio has become synonymous in a way with the peace process, and in large part because of 1995's Dayton Peace Accords. That's number one in your book, Under the Art of Diplomacy. Another former guest on this program was instrumental. They call him the architect of the Dayton Peace Accords, Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, who passed away a couple years ago. He's the toughest interview I've ever had on this show because Richard didn't suffer fools. And if he didn't want to answer the question, let's just move on. You began with this. This is obviously a very important moment in peace and in Dayton history.
Yes, absolutely. The people of Dayton, I believe, have a responsibility to keep that legacy alive because it's one of the few times in history where people got together and they created a treaty that actually stopped the killing. When the people came to Dayton, the three warring parties, a lot of people know the story, but there were 100,000 people killed in Bosnia in the wake of Marshal Tito and in the rise of Slobodan Milosevic. The idea was that Clinton administration brought the three warring presidents of warring parties to Dayton, Ohio, for a specific reason. One is that there's an Air Force base here, which was a show of arms, but also because it was out of the media area and people could really get down and negotiate and really try to find a solution to this growing problem, which some people consider a genocide. So when they came to Dayton, the Daytonians actually participated in that process. There was a lot of people that worked at the base. There were a lot of people who lined the entryway when the people came in the morning for the Dayton process, which was about a month long. There were people there with signs saying, get this war stopped. And when they took Milosevic out to the symphony and they took him to the mall and bought some shoes and things like that. But
they
people,
took him to the Amber Rose.
Did they? Mm-hmm. Well, it's great food. But, but anyway, Dayton's participated in that process. So we have a legacy that we need to keep in the public mind. So some folks created the Dayton Peace Prize, which went to several people, including Holbrooke. And then we created, there were several others that founded the Dayton International Peace Museum, and one of the first exhibits was the Dayton Peace Accords. The International Cities of Peace, which I'm a part of, started in Dayton. The Missing Peace Art Space, the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, the Salem Avenue Peace Corridor, it's just exploded from the idea that we need to keep that legacy alive.
So clearly, 17 years later, Dayton has become synonymous with peace.
Yes, Dayton means peace around the world. It literally, in the Balkans in particular, if you say Dayton, people get teary-eyed. That's exactly why some of them are living. The Dayton process, Richard Holbrooke went on to Charlie Rose and Good Morning America, and inevitably he would say, well, you know what the Middle East needs is a Dayton process, or Yugoslavia, where he spent his later days. Even on his deathbed, it's an interesting story, is when he was in the hospital and he was having complications from a surgery, before he rolled into the surgery where he would end his life, he looked at the doctor and said, you've got to end this war in Afghanistan. So right till the end, he just had an amazing wit and the tact that is absolutely essential in diplomacy.
Well, as intimidated as I was to interview him, I had the opportunity, because he was coming to give a speech in Dayton, and he had a new biography, actually an autobiography that he just put out. And so I talked to him on the telephone. At the time, he was in private industry. He was working for a big investment bank in New York. And I called him on the phone and did the interview, and it was a tough interview. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, I said, Ambassador Holbrooke, I only have one regret about this interview, and that is that I can't get you to autograph my book. And he said, well, give me your address. And he dutifully wrote down my address, and I thought, now is he really going to send me the book? And 2 days later, there was the envelope from the bank with a wonderfully inscribed copy of the book that
wow.
he had mailed me, and he
yeah.
took care of that little detail.
Little detail. That's
and,
absolutely
And
right.
I thought, wow.
Yeah.
Because I've had other authors make me the same promise, and mm-hmm. I'm still waiting for some of those books to show up.
Yeah. Yeah, the attention to detail is a huge part of it. When he passed away, the friends that he had were around the world. You know, for a cantankerous kind of guy, he just had an amazing amount of friends. The bridge in Dayton is named after Ambassador Richard Holbrook, and that is the start of the Peace Corridor downtown. So he has a legacy in Dayton.
The book is Elements of Peace, How Nonviolence Works, written by J. Frederick Arment. He joins us on the program today. Fred, in Chapter 6, Peacekeeping in East Timor, we encounter another very interesting situation and another person who has been on this program. He won the Nobel Peace Prize, José Ramos Horta, graduate of Antioch University.
Absolutely.
By a correspondence program once upon a time, and he was instrumental in hammering this together. Some listeners probably aren't familiar with this because it took place on the other side of the planet.
Yes, he actually became president of the new country of East Timor. It's an interesting story, and all of these little vignettes that we have, the 30 vignettes that give background, give a storytelling a dimension to these overall elements of peace, have amazing stories of some amazing men and women who have characteristics that they were able to lend to history in order to create a more peaceful world. Sometimes what they've done actually saved hundreds of thousands of lives. And I think Ramos Horta is one of them who, his personality was very humble. He actually wanted to become a novel writer, and that was his big wish, but he was thrown into this wave of history when the Indonesian country started to break down after World War II. They were backed by the United States. The United States was afraid of the domino effect, Indonesia falling to communism. So a lot of these different islands, hundreds of thousands of islands, began to think about breaking away. And East Timor broke away, but Hortos Ramos was the spokesperson at 26 years old. His father was a Portuguese immigrant. Portugal, actually, Indonesia was a colony of Portugal. And his father was basically sent away from the country because he was a politician. He married a Timorese woman whose four people in her family were killed by the Indonesian army. So he was thrust into this profile of becoming a spokesperson for a country that was rebelling against Indonesia. So he spent a lot of time in the United States, went to Antioch, graduated, went to New York, lived there. And when the war began, there were thousands and thousands of Timorese who were killed, and he became the spokesperson. Eventually, when the United Nations came in, thank God for the United Nations, they sent peacekeeping forces, and they were able to get the government to allow elections. And when Ramos Horta came back to Indonesia, he became the focus of the political opposition, and he eventually became president due to democratic election.
And it was Erwin Abrams, after José Ramos Horta won the Nobel Peace Prize, who brought him to Yellow Springs, and we actually had him on the program on a couple of occasions. And I've got to say, he's about the most serious person you could ever meet. He was still living in exile.
Yes.
And really an amazing story. Yeah. He's famous. Richard Holbrook is famous. Martin Luther King Jr., Jimmy Carter. You've got all these really famous people in this book that were involved in the peace process. And then you've got these people who I never heard of, and I love some of these stories. In Chapter 12, you've got a guy who was a conscientious objector in World War II. His name was Desmond Doss. We had a number of conscientious objectors from World War II who settled in Yellow Springs. That generation is now fading away, but they were very instrumental in this community. And he liked to call himself a conscientious cooperator.
Yeah.
And this guy The most amazing part of the story was this guy won the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Yes, as a conscientious objector.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And the story about his courage is written down in the actual letter for the commendation, the Medal of Honor. And he was a very humble person who lived in Columbus, actually. And he died just a few years ago after a long life, just as a regular Joe. And I think that conscientious objectors, going back to the legacy of Henry David Thoreau and others, it's a choice. It's a decision people make based on their moral consciousness. And I think that the character traits that we talk about in the book, each of these methods, environmentalism, alternative resource acquisition, creativity, artistic, each of these methods for creating peace is a choice that people make. How are you going to work in the world to make a better place? And global wellness is one that's in the book. You know, working for global wellness, Doctors Without Borders, becoming a nurse, becoming a doctor. It's my contention that everyone in the audience is a peacemaker. And because peace has such a bad name, it's so contentious because of a lot of the preconceived notions that people have about peacemakers and peacemaking. I think that we don't self-identify as peacemakers as readily as we should. It's become controversy, and I think it's a problem with our language in that peace has become something that is on the left or on the right, if you're talking about the peacemaker missile. But the language of peace has become something that should not be contentious, that people should embrace and self-identify with, and it's how you make peace in the world that expresses your individuality.
My guest is J. Frederick Arment. His new book is The Elements of Peace, How Nonviolence Works. This book has been published by McFarland, which is a very well-known publisher of a lot of academic texts. Is this going to be used in the classroom? I mean, what's going on with your book?
Yeah, it's actually just released this month, and we already have 13 universities that have taken a look at it for use in their peace education courses. So that's a really good thing to happen for the book and for peace in general. McFarland luckily has worldwide distribution, so it was a real boon to have it published by McFarland because peacemaking is becoming something that people are interested in, people are embracing. There's so many different conflict resolution courses, and universities are creating new degrees in conflict resolution. But I think that one of the main things, one of the main focuses of the book is an expansive view of peace. This expands the idea of peacemaking so that everyone can identify themselves as a peacemaker, from the person, you know, the plumber, you know, the artistic expression. How you create peace in the world can be as simple as doing a good job. And I think that is one of the keys of the book. There's many, many people who are famous, but each of us has the choice.
Another of your sections is 26, and it's about the Golden Rule. And this is a guy who, back in 1897, was the mayor of Toledo, Ohio. They called him Sam Golden Rule Jones. And this one was about reciprocity. And I think so many people could learn from this chapter because it was all about treating people fairly. And he had this business where he paid people really well and he expected them to do a good job. Mm-hmm. And I think this would be such a wonderful basis for people to run their businesses.
Yes.
But we don't do that, do we?
Right. As a matter of fact, he almost was run out of office for it. It's interesting. Toledo, Ohio. Golden Rule Jones, they called him. He was an oil man, actually. He was an immigrant to the United States. He went to work in the oil fields. He made a lot of money, but he had a sense of honesty. And so when he... you know, people started urging him to run for office because he had such a great reputation in the commercial world. And when he ran for office, he started creating parks for people. And this is late 19th century. This is around the year 1900. So this was very, very different for a very progressive mayor to be in Ohio at the time. And, you know, he ruffled some feathers. Mm. Honesty is not something that is lauded in our political world.
Well, I can see we're running out of time here. And before we do, I want to quickly talk to you about something kind of off the subject. Last year, we had a guest on the program who claims to have published the first electronic book back in the 80s. Now, you were kind of a pioneer, I know, in electronic publishing. Just in the last couple of weeks, I read where e-books are now outselling traditional books for the very first time. They have surpassed them. And I understand that you are in the process of republishing some of your earlier novels in electronic format. Is that true?
Yes, right. Nook and Kindle have given the opportunity for people to refresh their work and put it out, especially some things that are meaningful. So, you know, I had a novel come out in 2005, Backbeat, which is now available at Kindle and Nook. And then also there's a novel coming out, Synthesis, later this year, which is a spy versus spy political thriller. And I think that, you know, whoever said that they were the first ones to publish an e-book, they have to come up against history, because we created in Yellow Springs, actually, we created the first internet book publishing company that paid authors royalties. It was called FictionNet. And we were the first ones in the world to actually create a PDF book in Adobe format in 1995.
Well, this is Peter James, and this was back in the 80s, and it was kind of a joke.
I'll defer to him.
But you can look it up. He's a very well-known British novelist, and they did it kind of as a spoof, because in the book, they talk about an electronic book. So just for fun, they came up with this very primitive electronic book.
Kind of like the original Pong.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And it was kind of a fun thing. And of course, at the time, they all thought, oh, this is just a big joke. You know, no one will ever do this.
Now it's surpassed.
Well, Fred, we really appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much, Vic. I appreciate it.
Our guest has been J. Frederick Arment. His new book, The Elements of Peace, How Nonviolence Works, just published by McFarland. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. Donald Ray Pollock is one of my favorite writers. His first novel, The Devil All the Time, was my favorite work of fiction last year. It just came out in paperback, and we're going to be bringing you our interview with Donald Ray Pollock for The Devil All the Time next week in the Book Nook, because Donald Ray Pollock is going to be signing copies of the paperback at Blue Jacket Books in Xenia. That's 60 South Detroit Street at 6 o'clock on July 27th. That's a Friday. Donald Ray Pollock with The Devil All the Time. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.